From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we look at why the number of Black children who die by suicide has been growing and hear a suicide survivor's perspective. Then we'll tell you about an accessible production happening at the Milwaukee Rep and what they've changed to be more inclusive.
Kindness isn't always enough. We need to know how, we need to know why, and when we have that knowledge, then we're able to make better decisions. And then the disability community feels welcome.
We'll learn why the Latino Arts String Program's 10th Annual Guitar Festival is focusing on women.
The world of classical guitar is very male-dominated. And so for me, it's important that in this arena, we focus on women. It's an accomplishment to get to our 10th year. So it's celebrating an accomplishment with talented women that are coming.
Plus, learn about 5 things happening in Milwaukee this month. All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. The number of Black children who die by suicide has been growing faster than other racial and ethnic groups. In 2019, the Emergency Task Force on Black Youth Suicide and Mental Health reported that Black youth under 13 years old are twice as likely to die by suicide. Today, Amai Collins shares her story and struggles with mental health. Collins describes herself as a mom, a nurse, and a suicide survivor. She first had thoughts of suicide when she was a junior in high school. She joins WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. And a note to our listeners, this conversation focuses on the topic of suicide and one individual's experience with suicidal thoughts.
It started off as a feeling of depression, not really knowing what was going on with me, not really knowing who I was or who I wanted to be, and getting absorbed in what people thought I should have been or how pretty people thought I should be or just being judged or verbally bullied by people. That's when my thoughts first emerged. It got worse as months passed. It almost became super overpowering to anything positive going on around me. I was mostly to myself. I didn't spend any time with friends or anything. I just mostly worked at my job and school. And my first attempt was in my senior year of high school in January.
Amai, I want to first thank you for sharing your story with me and taking this space to be really vulnerable and tell your truth. Did your family and friends know that something was happening to you?
Yes, I would say anybody immediate to me, whether it was friends or family, noticed it. They noticed the change in my mood. They noticed the change in me laughing, me smiling. I didn't do much of that anymore. And I'm really big on, like, laughing. Always like to enjoy a laugh. I didn't do that anymore. I didn't talk about my day. And one thing I used to always do with my dad is, like, kind of talk about my day and what was going on. And I didn't do that anymore. So I would say that a lot of people did notice the switch, but they weren't really sure what it was. And for the simple fact that I wasn't sharing anything about what it was, it made it even harder for them to understand what it was. But some of their approaches also made it hard.
Tell me more about their approaches. What does that mean?
The approach was guarded, like the friend side, assuming that I was pushing them away in the hopes that I just didn't want to be friends anymore without, you know, specifically inquiring about what was going on. The adult side of things was thinking that it was a phase, possibly thinking that it would get better or I would be okay in a short amount of time, and that was also not true.
Amai, I think you bring up a good point and one that I've seen experts and advocates really talk about, especially for Black youth in crisis, the idea that it's a phase and they'll grow out of it. Did these sorts of responses worsen how you were already feeling?
Yes. You know, as real and as blunt as that may seem, it did make it worse because it caused me to be more guarded in you know, what the problem really was, or trying to even understand what the problem really was with other people. It made me not want to share feelings, made me extremely closed off because the approach was, it was rough. A non-open approach to any capacity will cause an individual to be guarded. That can be detrimental to, you know, one, because it can lead to attempts or, you know, secluding oneself, self-harm. So I will say the approach did make it worse, and I'm not blaming them for, you know, making it worse, but, you know, because they didn't know how to approach it, but people are people, so approaching it in the sense of thinking that it's immediately something personal between people when it's really something personal between oneself.
Was there medical intervention for you?
There was never a diagnosis, but there was a understanding that therapy was needed, and it was attempted, but it was a really rough approach to what was going on with me. It was almost kind of talked about as senioritis or something I could just solve by simple techniques, and that was also a really rough response to what I was going through as well.
Amaya, you've described the approach that folks took to try and assist you as rough. And I'm wondering, what does that say about how Black girls in general are addressed when they have mental health concerns?
That's a great topic in itself, because I don't think it's addressed, because it's either not considered a huge problem, or, again, it's something that can be solved because of our approach at certain situations. With Black girls, it's this stigma that it has something to do with the friends we're choosing, or it has something to do with what we choose to spend our time on, or, you know, men or boys or, you know, whatever it may be. But it's also that serious, because a lot of the times it's coming from past trauma. It's coming from self-inflicted thoughts, watching other people and getting absorbed in what other people think, and, you know, more people being attracted to this or going towards that. And I think that with Black girls, it is definitely looked over, or it's almost seen too late, because you just started a phase, or they were sad, or they were just going through school, or it was just a, you know, time that's so inaccurate to the real situation.
In a previous conversation, we talked about how you're no stranger to talking publicly about your experience with suicide. What does being able to talk about it do for you today?
Today, it's extremely comforting, and I would say gratitude, because it's like an appreciation for my voice and the situation at hand, because there are so many other people who are able to talk about their own stories. And for me to be able to voice mine, and for people to have someone to relate to, whoever it may be, that for me is just such a well-rounded feeling, because it's not about me when I'm talking about, you know, it's about me, but it's not about me when I'm talking about it. Yes, it's me voicing my own story, but there are, you know, millions or thousands of people, whether it's women, men, transgenders, anybody that are going through similar situations or similar feelings and have no way to talk about it, or just aren't comfortable talking about it. And for me, that's what makes me want to continue, because if I didn't have that, or if I couldn't think about the fact that it was helping other people, I would, you know, not be talking about it. I have, you know, gotten into a place in life where I can speak about it on any platform and anywhere, and, you know, won't drop a tear, just because, you know, it was something that I've been through. It was something that I beat, conquered, and it's something that I know that not a walk in the park, and it's not something easy, and I would never discredit another person's situation regarding suicide or depression and discredit that just because they can't talk about it.
You already answered my next question, which was going to be, is suicide something that lingers with you? But you're saying this is something you've beat, you've conquered.
I would say yes. I haven't. I'm not saying that it won't happen again, but I don't. They don't ever cross my mind anymore. I do still have a lot of depressed thoughts at times, but they don't manifest into suicidal ones anymore because of, I would say, my mental approach, my vocal approach to those things.
Amai Collins, a suicide survivor. She shared her experience with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. If you or anyone you know is in a crisis or thinking about suicide, trained help is available for you. You can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988. It's Black History Month, and here's a piece of state history you may not have known. The first doctor in Wisconsin was a Black woman named Mary Ann LaBouche. The director of Marquette Law School's Lubar Center, Derek Mosley, joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to share her story.
It's pretty interesting the fact that the first doctor in the state of Wisconsin was an African-American woman. And the fact that we don't teach this in schools is sad because it's a great, great story. And when I say she was the first, she was the only doctor in the area, which was that we now call Wisconsin. About 1816, when Fort Crawford was built in Prairie du Chien, and then they brought a surgeon with her. But prior to that, she was the only show in town as far as a doctor in Wisconsin. And she was born Mary Ann LaBouche. She comes from mixed parentage. She was born a slave. And so she has a slave background, but her father was French. And so she was LaBouche, but she married three times. And so she's taken several names over the course of time, but it's either Mary Ann LaBouche or Mary Ann Menard, which was her last husband. But all of her patients called her Aunt Mary Ann. Aunt Mary Ann was the first and only doctor in the state of Wisconsin prior to 1816.
And how did she become a doctor? Do we know that part of history about how she got into that field?
Yeah. So what wasn't very uncommon in enslaved populations is that there were people who were part of that population who were well-versed in what they called the healing arts. And so they would come up with different potions using different types of flowers and herbs they would find. And they would call them yarb drinks, or yarb potions. This yarb drink was very common in enslaved populations as well as indigenous populations. And it was a mixture of herbs and flowers that they would put together and mash, and they would either dilute them with a liquid or they would just have them chew on these herbs and flowers on their own. And so that's what she was known for. People would call her to travel all throughout the state to try these healing potions, and essentially, if they couldn't be healed in her house, in their house, she would bring them back to her house in Prairie du Chien and essentially nurse them back to health. Even when a doctor, a surgeon came in 1816 to build Fort Crawford in Prairie du Chien, people still sought her out for her yarb potions. And that's how she became the first doctor in the state of Wisconsin. Arguably the greatest story about her involved an incident which happened in 1827 when there was an altercation between the Winnebago tribe and people who lived in Prairie du Chien. And one of the kids was actually stabbed and scalped. And that child was actually the one-year-old granddaughter of Aunt Mary Ann. And she knew enough to take a silver plate and place that plate on the head of this child. And she knew that silver was a potent antibacterial agent. And the skin was able to heal back over the head and the brain, and it kept bacteria out. The silver kept bacteria out. So it's a pretty remarkable story about Aunt Mary Ann being the first doctor and being of African-American descent.
definitely a really interesting part of our state's history that I definitely didn't know about. And she definitely was around at the foundation of what we know now as the state of Wisconsin. And there's another significant and historic town in Wisconsin that was recently awarded and received historical status this summer called the town of Lake Ivanhoe. Judge Mosley, tell me a bit about the history of this town. Why was Lake Ivanhoe awarded this high honor?
There were three prominent African-American men in Chicago. One was an attorney, one was a business executive, and the third was a politician. And they worked alongside their white counterparts and noticed every weekend they were traveling up to Wisconsin to Lake Geneva to spend time around the lake, live in, have cabins up there, cottages up there, and they would swim and boat and fish. And they thought to themselves, why don't we go to Lake Geneva? We have the money to afford our own place up there. And so they went up to Lake Geneva and tried to buy property, but it was the 1920s. And due to racial discrimination, no one would sell property to them. So they actually found property, a place for sale called Ryan Farm. And it was about 7 miles outside of Lake Geneva. And they had a white real estate agent from Evanston, Illinois, who effectuated this transaction for them. And that agent's name was Ivan Bell. And so they purchased 83-acre farm. It had a lake on it. And they decided, we're going to make our own Black Lake Geneva. And they said, well, what are we going to name it? And they're like, well, let's name it Ivanhoe after Ivan Bell. If it wasn't for Ivan Bell, we wouldn't have this property. And so Lake Ivanhoe was born in 1926. And it was a place that was plotted out with streets and plats of land. In fact, the streets were named after famous African Americans. So there's a Frederick Douglass Road, there's a Crispus Attucks Road, there's a DuSable Road, who was the founder, a Black man who was the founder of Chicago. And so all of these roads still exist to this day. And so 1926, they built this huge pavilion, it was called, and they had a ballroom, and they invited Cab Calloway, the famous band leader from the Cotton Club in Harlem, and he came out, and it was a great event, and Black families would come up, and they would spend their summers up in Wisconsin and Lake Ivanhoe, and it became the lake, the Black Lake Geneva. But it was also around the 20s, and the Depression hit, and when the Great Depression hit, it wiped out the money of the founders, the three founders I mentioned earlier, and it wiped out a lot of the money of the African-American families who would come up to Lake Ivanhoe. And so the dream of the Black Lake Geneva died, but as time passed, Black families tended to come back to Lake Ivanhoe, especially around the 1960s. And these families would come back and they would build houses. And as of today's date, there are 461 residents of Lake Ivanhoe. 9% of them are African-American who trace their roots from Chicago coming up to Lake Ivanhoe.
Derek Mosley is the director of Marquette Law School's Lubar Center. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang regularly for their monthly With Mosley series. And you can hear more of their conversations at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. In about 20 minutes, we'll tell you about five things happening in the Milwaukee area this month. But first, we'll learn about a Shakespeare production at the Milwaukee Rep that's designed to be accessible to all people. We'll tell you how, coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee Rep's latest production is Shakespeare's rom-com Much Ado About Nothing. Next Tuesday, February 7th, the theater company is presenting a special performance of the show, its first all-access performance. It's designed to be a comfortable experience for people with vision or hearing impairments, as well as people with autism or other social, cognitive, or physical challenges that create sensory sensitivities. And it's part of Milwaukee Rep's wider effort to be accessible to all. WUWM's Lena Tran spoke to Jenny Toutant of Milwaukee Rep and Katie Cummings of Pink Umbrella Theater Company about the upcoming performance. Cummings starts off by explaining what her company does.
Our focus is to engage and empower disabled actors and artists. One of the things that we offer as a company is professional development to other theater companies in creating sensory-friendly performances, and excited to partner with a rep who's actually doing it right. They have started from the very beginning. They brought us in. They're doing so many different types of access. So with the captions, with ASL, with an audio description, we've got the touch tour, which helps not only people who are of low vision, but also people who have sensory sensitivities might need or want to touch some of the items that are on stage. And so having those things available throughout the performance, in addition to, like, we talk a little bit about dampening loud bursts of noises and those kinds of things, right? It's a rock show. It's really fun. But we talked a lot with the designers about how can we make sure that those are accessible moments and still keep the intent, because it's not about dumbing down the show or taking things out. It's about making sure that the show is built in a way that is as sensory friendly as possible.
Have you thought about this targeted towards a certain age or something?
So it's Much Ado About Nothing, right? So it's Shakespeare. Primarily, I would say that middle school age level and up, like that 12 through adult. This is also set in the 90s, right? So a lot of adults will experience some nostalgia, right, with some of the music, the rock music, the focus on that grunge era, the costumes, but also with the, you know, a lot of accessibility opportunities are focused on a younger age groups, right? So this is an opportunity for adults with various levels of disabilities or sensitivities, because we all have different sensitivities to light or sound or different needs, right? And while we're experiencing a production, right? So this particular performance is also an all access performance. We'll have it live captioned. We will have ASL as well as changing some of the elements of the production to make it more sensitive friendly. Katie, do you want to actually talk about that process and who you invited to see the production as well, to be able to identify some of those sensitivities?
Yeah, sure. So we feel that it's really important to have a person with sensory sensitivities at the leadership table, right? So our friend Clayton Mortal, who loves Shakespeare, he's an actor in town. He also has heightened sensitivities. He came to see, we were here for a run through, and then we were also here for opening night to see it with the full house and everything. And he and I just kind of jotted down notes. So things that he noticed were things like, there is transition music with an electric guitar, so he made the suggestion of using an acoustic guitar instead for that evening's performance, the sensory-friendly performance. Some other things, too, there's certain moments where the lights are flashing that he picked up on that we didn't. This house is beautiful, and it seats so many people, but the rep is kind enough to, like, to lower that attendance policy so that people have the ability to get up and move, sit wherever they like. The designers have designed the show in a way that if they sit kind of hugging the wall on either side, there's less sound there than there is in the middle. So if you have sensory avoiders, you know, we're going to suggest that they sit kind of closer to the side of the house. But if you have sensory seekers, then sitting right in the middle is going to give them kind of the full experience. We've come in and done also 6 hours of professional development with everybody here at the rep on disability, autism, sensory sensitivities, and like best practices that we're finding as we move through this process together.
Pink Umbrella Theater has been just essential to this partnership and being able to launch this. We knew that we needed to do this show, right? This is the right thing to do. It's part of our mission is to have an audience that's representative of Milwaukee's rich diversity, and we want to make sure that we're looking at all dimensions of diversity in that. So one of the most obvious things for us to do was to go, let's call Pink Umbrella instead of trying to go, what are we supposed to do? Let's talk to the experts on as we're all learning and developing and growing and advancing our equity, diversity, and inclusion work.
Katie, you made this point that it was so helpful that they reached out to you from the very beginning of the production. What difference did that make for you in terms of the work, or why was that especially useful?
I've been following this trend, right, for the past 5 years and even longer in my previous position. And a lot of times it's an afterthought for theaters. And when it becomes that afterthought, it's like a scramble to get everything together. Instead, we had a conversation maybe close to a year ago, and we started talking about what are the needs? What are we looking for? We're able to write grants to, you know, obtain the sensory bags, the headphones, the fidgets that might be necessary. We were able to have conversations with the production designers from the very beginning, and that is something that everybody then was on board with, like, cool, we're going to use an electric guitar for this transition, but we're noting that when we fast forward to that sensory-friendly performance, we're going to need to have an alternative because that might be something that triggers. The fact that the rep is, like, forward-thinking about this, and leaders in the community, they are theatrical leaders in the community. They've been a staple here for my whole life. And when they say we're committed to this, they are absolutely committed to it, and they're doing it right. The other thing that I've found in the disability community is that so often people say we're doing it, but they don't know why. The fact that the rep has taken the time to really learn about disability, about sensory sensitivities, they now know the why, and they're able to make informed decisions about the how, right? And that's a really important thing. And I'm grateful. I give Jenny, like, props right back. Like, I'm grateful that the whole staff here has been open to having those conversations, learning something new, and not just being kind. Kindness isn't always enough. We need to know how, we need to know why, and when we have that knowledge, then we're able to make better decisions. And then the disability community feels welcome. They know that we've thought from everything from access to the building, access in the building, the quiet zone that we're putting in, all of those things. Let the disability community know we've thought this through.
I can imagine that if it's like a day before the show and you're like, oh no, I need to find someone to record an acoustic guitar. There's so many hurdles like that would quickly become insurmountable without long-term planning.
We also have a social narrative, which we've actually, after we wrote that social narrative, went, oh, we could do this for every show. This is an easy win for us just to show what happens when you enter the building from all the way from parking all the way through getting into a seat and what will happen through the performance and how you exit the building and how you identify where a bathroom is and all of that, right? Just from the beginning to end, what that experience is. And there's so many people who haven't experienced live theater, and you know, I work in the education department, so we have a lot of students that come through for the first time in the theater, that's just going to be a great best practice for us to have moving forward, right? So there's a lot that we've also learned from this in some of those accommodations of, oh, that's an easy thing that we can just keep doing. The house is going to open a bit earlier than normal. The lobby will open about an hour before the show, where people can explore in that lobby these different materials before they come down and see and find a seat. You know, so there's some opportunities then to be able to come early and kind of explore, get a sense of the surroundings, and be able to, you know, find where the quiet room is, where are the bathrooms, where are the things that I might need during the show. Do I need a sensory bag, right, of materials that I might want, right? So being able to assess the situation and find out where I need to sit and where I might need to go.
Is the hope that you will have a show like this for other shows that Milwaukee Rep has going on in the future?
Yes, our vision is that we certainly have an all-access performance in the future, that this is going to be this is our first step in a very long journey in creating accessibility for all.
Are there any kind of considerations or things that the actors or the tech crew needs to be keeping in mind for that day?
I think a lot of what we prepare them for is what we talked about is just changing some of the music, changing some of the volume. Maybe there's lighting cue can get skipped, you know, if it is something that's a little too flashy. One of the things that we're seeing right now is the lighting in the house is already at half right now, and that would stay that way throughout the entire performance so that we don't have so much darkness as we often experience in the theater. So there's a lot of modifications that are happening in, you know, some of it is very subtle, right? Because we're still trying to keep to, here is the intent and the artistic narrative of this production, right? And keeping that intent there is really important. But what are some of the changes that we can be able to make throughout that performance from that production end in that lighting and that sound? And that's really the biggest things, lighting and sound, that are the modifications that are being made.
For you, Jenny, do you feel like this has changed the way that you see the different elements of production? Talking about lighting and sound, do you see, or do you feel that you've learned a different way of looking at those things?
I believe so. I think that what's really helpful, like Katie was saying earlier too, with having Clayton come in, there are things that we don't necessarily see as somebody who does not identify as disabled, right? Of, I don't necessarily notice that these lights are flashing and that might be a trigger, right? I don't necessarily notice that electric guitar might be a little too much, right? So there's a number of things of like, oh, just raising that awareness And being able to go, you know, one of the suggestions that Clayton had was, can we have trigger warnings in, you know, throughout any of the shows? Because maybe I just want to come to a regular performance, and if I know that there's electric guitar, then that would be really helpful to know, right? So really being able to think about for the future, what can we do continuously, I think is really going to be important for us too.
And what's your vision for this particular show, February 7th? Who do you hope to see in the audience?
We hope to see the adult disability community. 1 in 5 adults in the state of Wisconsin identify with a disability, and the largest population is here in Milwaukee. And one of the things I'm most excited about as a partner organization with the REP is that they sensory friendly tends to evoke kid friendly. This is not a kid friendly show. This is an adult show. It's about love and romance, and you know, there's all sorts of hijinks that happen. And the disability community, as we talk about diversity, it is just as diverse. Right? There are people who want to see adult theater and they still have sensory sensitivities or need captions or would like ASL or, you know, or a touch tour. So what I'm excited most and what I'm hopeful for most is that this place is full of adults who identify and people who support this kind of work and make sure that we are here, that the audience is able to engage in the best way that they can and just belly laugh. It's a great, it's a fun show. It's so well done. And that's what I'm hopeful for on the 7th.
Jenny Tutant is the Chief Education and Engagement Officer at the Milwaukee REP. Katie Cummings is the founder of the Pink Umbrella Theater Company. They both spoke to WUWM's Lena Tran. That music you're hearing is being played by Gohar Vardanian. She'll be one of the headliners for the Latino Arts String Program Annual Guitar Festival. This is the 10th year they're hosting the event with Latino Arts, and it all started as a way for young guitarists to compete and meet professionals in the field. Now, a decade later, the festival has evolved to include more workshops and opportunities to get feedback from international talent. Denora Marquez is director of the Latino Arts String Program. Gohar Vardanian is a classical guitarist, and she'll be one of the headliners at the event. They both join Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
This year, the Latino Arts Strings program is celebrating its 10th annual guitar festival this weekend with Latino Arts Incorporated. And for the first time in 2 years, the event will be entirely in person. And Dinora, for this year's festival, how are we celebrating the 10th annual guitar festival? This is a really big year.
It is a huge year. Yes, this is our 10th anniversary, and we're celebrating by focusing on women performers. It was a real hope for us to be able to do this, and we're just thrilled to be able to have Gohar Vardanian join us. And the other ways that we're celebrating is, yes, by coming back fully in person, and we have another soloist who will be joining us, Puerto Rican guitarist Leonela Alejandro. And we will have everything about the youth competition happen in person. The last 2 years, we 1 year did totally online, and then we did partially online and in person, which kind of made our festival a little bit international. We had a lot of different countries participating. But this time around, we really felt that it was important to get back to the intimacy of a competition that's in person, and the soloists getting to give their wisdom and their knowledge to these young aspiring guitarists. So we're excited about it.
Yeah, it definitely does sound exciting. I do want to ask, why was the theme this year celebrating women guitarists and women musicians?
Well, you know, it's actually the theme for all our programming this year for Latino Arts. And we did discuss it, and I said, well, it would be perfect if we could do that also for the festival. So we decided to join the whole theme of Latino Arts and focus on women performers. But I just want to say that the world of classical guitar is very male dominated. And so for me, it's important that in this arena, we focus on women. And I think that that's huge. It's an accomplishment to get to our 10th year. So it's celebrating an accomplishment with the amazing accomplishment of the talented women that are coming.
Gohar, you are one of the guitarists that will be headlining the event, and you have performed all over the world from places like Italy to Panama and continue to maintain a private studio in New York City. Just to bring it back to the beginning of your musical career, Gohar, how did you first pick up the guitar? Why were you drawn to it?
Well, I was introduced to the guitar by my dad. I was probably around 4 or 5 when I started taking lessons from him. Or he was giving me lessons, it wasn't me taking them. It was more like that he decided that his daughter or whatever child he would have would play the guitar. So it wasn't really my choice to begin with, but it came with its perks in terms of new toys, candy, ice cream, you know, if I practiced. So I've been with the guitar my entire life, so I don't know any different. I've always been surrounded by guitar. So personally, I never, even though I would always be the only girl playing, I never really like thought of it any differently because I came from a guitarist dad. I was surrounded by guitarists. I was just a person playing guitar. It's just when you grow up, you start realizing that there are fewer of us playing the instrument, although that's now changing. So I was introduced to it by my dad, and then I just kind of continued, and guitar became the reason we moved to the United States. I'm from Armenia originally, and it just became me. I don't know myself any differently without a guitar in my hands.
It's just so phenomenal that this is a craft and an art that you have had throughout your entire life. And personally, I don't consider myself a musician or a guitarist, but I do admire the practice and the love that musicians like yourself have for the art. Gohar, why do you keep playing? How do you continue to feel so connected to the craft?
Well, I mean, at some point it becomes your job, right? So this is my career. So if I don't stay connected to my guitar, I won't be able to pay my bills. So it's really not that romantic. I love the guitar. I do that every day, but sometimes I have to really practice out of responsibility and not necessarily inspiration. Because once you choose that as a career, you're responsible for a quality of a concert, a quality of a recording. So it's what you do. You have to do it. But I do love it. And I love teaching. And it's nice to have that balance that I don't have to only perform, because I would feel like I would probably burn out if I had to travel all the time for performances. So I have the balance between teaching incredible people. A lot of my students are adults, hobbyists who play guitar for fun. And it's nice to see their inspiration to play the guitar. They're sometimes even more motivated than I am because they're doing it for fun. I sometimes have to force myself to practice, right? Because it's my job to do so. And seeing my students who just like love these instruments, and for me to teach them, it kind of inspires me. Like, well, if he can do it or she can do it, and after 8 hours of working and they sit down to practice, what's my excuse, you know, not to sit down and do my work? And that balance has kept me going for over 34 years. I'm 38, so I've been playing since I was 4-ish. That takes, you have to kind of balance it out, otherwise you can easily burn out. If I don't practice for a little bit, maybe like a week or two, that's the maximum I can go before I start missing the actual physical feeling of touching the instrument. Not necessarily like listening to the music and stuff, because I can do that, you know, on my iPod or even just hearing my students play. But the physical sensation of playing the guitar, because I've done it for so long, if I don't do it for a while, I miss it. So that keeps me going for sure.
You'll be bringing your guitar and performing for this festival coming up on February 4th. And just to get, I guess, a little sneak peek for people who are interested in going to the event, Gohar, what can people expect to see in your performance or hear you play?
Well, for this program, because it is the Latin arts we're trying to celebrate as well, not that it was very hard for me to do so, because most of guitar repertoire is either Spanish or from composers from Latin America. But specifically for this program, I chose composers only from Latin America and Spain. So I won't be playing Bach, I won't be playing any other composers. So it'll start with music from Argentina by Astor Piazzolla. Then we'll go a little bit further north to Paraguay for two pieces by Agustin Barrios. Then going a little bit further north to Venezuela, and finally crossing the Atlantic back to Spain, where kind of guitar all started, playing 3 pieces by Albéniz, who's actually a Spanish piano composer. And these pieces are transcriptions for the guitar. So it will be very Spanish Latin American program.
Dinora, bringing it back 10 years ago to the very first festival. When it first started, why was this festival created 10 years ago?
You know, I'm really glad you bring that up because it ties a little bit into everything that Gohar has been saying. We started this in greater part for the educational aspect that it could have for our students. We wanted to have the youth competition element in the festival. And there is not in the region a youth competition that's similar to this. So we do attract people from the surrounding states. And so as a violinist, I know that there's a lot of options for competitions for young violinists, but not as much for young guitarists. So we were excited to do that to show our students in the Latino Art Strings program what the life of a guitarist might look like, what competitions might look like, and to expose them to wonderful performers. And I'm going back to Gohar on this because it's also very exciting to us that you are an educator on the guitar. There's an element of a master class for the festival, and we're really excited that we'll have some students playing for you and getting feedback from you. So that element was a big part, a big motivator for starting the festival. There are other performance festivals in the region, obviously, but having this element, this component, was really what pushed us to make it happen.
Dinora Marquez is the director of the Latino Art String Program. Gohar Vardanian is a classical guitarist, and she'll be one of the headliners at the event. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. The 10th annual Guitar Festival will take place on Sunday, February 4th at the Latino Arts in the United Community Center. Next, we'll learn about some of the many events happening in Milwaukee in honor of Black History Month. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It may be cold, but Milwaukeeans aren't spending February indoors and out of sight. There's so many events happening this month that it was hard for Lake Effect contributor Sam Woods to narrow it down to a mere five, but that's exactly what he's done. Woods is a staff reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and every month he chats with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about some of the many events happening in the city.
There is a lot that is happening in Milwaukee mm-hmm. this month, especially because it is Black History Month.
Yes.
So many organizations celebrate in the city. Of course, we have legacy organizations that mm-hmm. celebrate Black History year-round.
Yep.
And the first event is with an organization that both celebrates Black History year-round, but is also having a special focus on it mm-hmm. this month.
Yes. So, you know, as you mentioned, February is Black History Month, but, you know, Black History is relevant kind of year-round, right? And so there are those year-round institutions, Wisconsin Black Historical Society, America's Black Holocaust Museum, you know, those are worth a visit February and any time in the year, right? But yes, during February, Milwaukee Film, as part of their Black Lens program, is putting on just a series of film screenings and events around themes like Black history trivia, Black love, like a bunch of different kinds of like touch points for Black history. And so while there's a ton of stuff going on for Black History Month in Milwaukee, and it feels kind of wrong to just single one out, right? And I should say the Neighborhood News Service has a full list of things to do during Black History Month. So check us out at MilwaukeeNNS.org for that. But yeah, just as a starting point, I would recommend Milwaukee Film's Black History Month programming. There's so many events and film screenings. I'm sure you can find something that interests you.
The next event, also arts-related, mm-hmm. it's something that's been going on for a while and has kind of evolved and transitioned into something a bit more permanent?
Yes. So Nicole Acosta is a Milwaukee-based multidisciplinary artist. And back in 2019, she started taking portraits of people wearing hoop earrings and asking them to reflect on what hoop earrings mean to them. And since 2019, she's taken that project to Chicago, to Brooklyn, to Los Angeles, doing the kind of same kind of things, doing like personal photographs of people wearing hoop earrings. And particularly, I should say, people of the global majority, so like Black, Brown, Indigenous, people of color, wearing hoop earrings and asking, what do hoop earrings mean to you? And so it's blossomed from this kind of just like one photo session and kind of question session into a whole art exhibition, which is on at the Marin Art and Culture Hub from early February through early April, where you can see, I think, 66 of these photographs and personal stories of these mostly women who have been part of this project in those four cities. But there's also concurring next month, so it's not quite a February thing, but it's related. There will be a play that was adapted from this photo project on at the Milwaukee Chamber Theater, actually right across the street from the Marin Art and Culture Hub. And if you want to get a sneak peek of this play in February, Milwaukee Chamber Theater has this Here to Play program, which has the actors do live readings of the script while they're still kind of getting used to it. And so they'll take select scenes and kind of do a dramatic reading of it. And so if you want to get a sneak peek of what Hoops of the Play is going to look like, that'll be at the Marin Art and Culture Hub in early to mid-February, I think February 8th. So check out Hoops, check out Nicole Acosta, really interesting Milwaukee-based art projects that's getting recognition around the country and around the world. So, like, check it out.
The next event is also arts-related. It is specifically at the 16th Street Health Center. It's a gallery night.
Yeah, so you might... So someone who's familiar with 16th Street Health Centers knows that they're primarily in... they provide, you know, affordable health care and do a lot of community events around healthcare, so like free COVID shots, flu shots, things like that. This month, they have a gallery night with art from local artists and community groups and youth that is for sale and for enjoyment on this gallery night. You know, if you're interested in kind of supporting 16th Street Health Centers and their kind of mission to provide affordable and accessible healthcare, and also want to kind of get a taste of local and youth-made art in Milwaukee, this would be a good place to do both of those things in one night.
So a lot of different ways to engage with the arts.
Yes.
This February.
I promise I won't. Not everything is art related, but it is something. I mean, it's interesting stuff, right?
Yeah. The next thing is definitely not art related. I mean, they certainly
there
do
art. There is an
art
to politics. Yes.
There is an art to politics. It is the candidate forum for MPS School Board.
Yes. So if you are not aware, there is an election coming up. In February, there's a primary election that actually school board races will not be on just because there's not enough candidates for a primary. So they'll wait until the April election. But in February, you'll have races on your ballot for, I believe, judge positions.
Wisconsin Supreme Court.
And the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which I'm sure WUWM 89.7 is all over that.
We are all over it. We will have a voter guide coming out very soon all about the Supreme Court race.
Excellent. So definitely check out the voter guide for the Supreme Court race. But if you want to get to know the candidates for school board before voting on them and kind of get to ask your questions, there's a candidate forum. It's hosted or it's organized by a bunch of neighborhood groups, so Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, the Hmong American Women's Association, the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations for Hope, and I apologize, there's some other neighborhood groups and local groups that have been involved in organizing this. But it's the first in-person forum for MPS school board candidates since 2019, so it's a chance to get to know the candidates, even though they will not be on the February ballot. You know, the Milwaukee School Board has control over a budget over $1 billion. And that's, you know, that's your tax dollars. And that's something that, you know, you have a right to ask the candidates what they're going to do with that money, right?
And the April general election is going to come up much faster than you might imagine.
Yes. I mean, it's the first week of April, so you know how that works. Like, last week of March, you think like, oh, that's so far away. And then it's like next Tuesday.
So the final event, this is actually the 10th
yes.
annual
Pew, 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 pew.
February.
Yes, yes. Big deal, big deal. So those that know February, so it's a celebration of the, celebration of the Vietnamese soup called pho and the local restaurants that sell it, that provide it. And so it's primarily based around the Silver City neighborhood, but it's kind of branched out at least this year. So there's three restaurants that will be offering deals on bowls of pho, and I believe some other items as well. Vientiane Noodle Shop, Thai Barbecue, those are both at like 35th and National, and Asia Rican Foods around 35th and Lincoln. I apologize, I don't remember the exact place, but around 35th and Lincoln. And so whether you are a longtime fan of pho, whether you are new to it or not, this is a chance to, you know, eat bowls of pho on a discount. And let me tell you, like with these around 0 degree days we've been having, like a bowl of hot pho is just like, it will turn your whole day around.
It's the best thing when it's very cold.
Oh God, yes, the best. There's a reason they do this in February, and it's not just the pun of February. Like, it is needed.
So lots of ways to get out into the community this month. As always, Sam, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Sam Woods is a staff reporter at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he joins us every month to talk about some of the events happening in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn, Robert Larry, and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach, Susan Bentz, Emily Files, Lena Tran, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation about how to talk to children about racism. Plus, we'll bring a book recommendation for Black History Month in our Book of the Month series. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.